I want to tell you this. Everything that I'm going to show you right now, I want to preface it with this comment. We are working well together. We had very productive meetings in Washington, D.C. with Secretary Burwell. What I'm going to show you are the concerns that we have. This is not to undermine proposals that have been given that we've seen in the past. This is not to say no, but it's to really emphasize that if the state of Utah is going to expand Medicaid coverage to a new population, we better get it right. We have to balance our budget. We have a federal government that created taxes for ACA. They have a revenue stream, and when their revenue stream runs out, they can print money. The state of Utah has no revenue stream for this, and we have to balance our budget. So you have to mitigate your risk as much as possible. So what I'm going to show you today are some of the challenges that we should all be aware of that exist, looking at the data from other states and some of the things that are happening in other states with their expansion to learn from those, but with the end goal of getting it right, whatever that may be. And I think that what we have the dance partner of the federal government, if this administration would like to see this come to scale, they're going to have to start paying attention to what Republican states are worried about in this space and what we're talking about, and look at waivers that will comport with the way we do our budgets here in the state of Utah. And so let me just start off with a clip. This cuts into my time so badly, but you've got to see this clip. This is after the session was over, okay? This is early April. If it's not April 2nd, it's in and around that date, okay? This is after all the discussion you've heard about Medicaid expansion or Medicaid payments and everything. This was a news clip that came about 3 weeks later.
Imagine getting a letter saying your insurance benefits were coming to an end immediately. That just happened to thousands of Utahns on Medicaid. Andrew Adams learned the state sent the letter, and then they're saying now it's not our fault.
Yeah, Deanie, this is the letter. It went out to 12,000 people. A lot of folks received it in their emails. It warns them that their transitional Medicaid benefit is coming to an end immediately. Now, there is good news at the end of this story, but some people are saying there's got to be a better way.
Just out of the blue, your coverage is ending.
John Felt read it and couldn't believe it.
It says right there, your Medicaid benefits will end effective March 31st.
The same day the letter was dated.
Not your coverage might end. Not your coverage, you know, is in limbo. But yeah, it's ending. You're out of luck is basically what it said.
This letter from the Utah Department of Workforce Services went out to about 12,000 Utahns, telling them their 12-month transitional Medicaid benefit was ending. It said Congress had not approved funding beyond March. Cruel words for Felt, whose wife is expecting a baby in May.
We don't have enough money just to take care of our own needs, not to mention the thousands of medical bills just for the pregnancy.
That's, of course, something that can cause some frustration for our customers, and we understand that.
Nick Dunn with the Department of Workforce Services says it's on Congress. The state, he says, was waiting to the very end of the session late last week to see if funding would be authorized. It wasn't.
We totally sympathize with people.
He says the state scrambled to notify people as quickly as possible.
Historically, Congress has funded this program, usually toward the tail end of their session before they go on recess. So this is a new thing for us to deal with.
Dunn says good news arrived late this afternoon from the feds. They told the state to continue the coverage, assuming Congress will ultimately approve funding.
It's great news that we won't lose our coverage. I mean, that's what was scaring us the most.
But Felt says an earlier warning would have been nice.
To get it on the same day with absolutely no notice, it's inexcusable. It's bad business.
I am told that it'll take the state about a week to reopen all of those cases. And in the meantime, what do you do if you have this kind of coverage? We're told continue to seek medical care as you would have before. If it was covered before, it's still covered. Those claims will be paid. Back to you.
All right.
So there's three takeaways I want you to realize from that. First off, I've heard a lot of conversation about federal money does not dry up. It does not disappear. All these promises of funding will always be there. I think one of the takeaways from this clip is that is exactly true until it's not. Okay? You can find very quickly that the federal government can change its formulas or just simply not fund something as they are grappling with their budgets and what they want to do with the federal dollars that they appropriate. Second issue, I've heard a lot about, let's just do it for 2 years. Let's have a pilot. Pilots usually are about, you know, a small group of people. You provide it in education. It's a few elementary schools, middle schools, get data, learn from it, then go to scale statewide. When we talk pilot with Medicaid expansion, we're talking everyone. The argument has been, if it doesn't work, if the uncertainty happens, if the funding formula is interrupted, we just end it, okay? We cut it off. And the argument, I've said, is that really fair to people, yo-yoing benefits back and forth? Everyone has said having it for some short amount of time is just so much better than having never had it at all. I did not glean that from the gentleman on the camera right there, that he was just grateful to have had his Medicaid coverage for some amount of time. And it is really okay if Congress doesn't prioritize it because he's had it. And in fact, I want to meet the people who've enjoyed any kind of coverage, find out that that coverage is going away, and I want to have the conversation where they're just glad that they've had this, that there isn't frustration, that there isn't anger. I think you have to seriously contemplate what it means in people's lives when you make promises, particularly as a state, and then you don't back it up. The third thing, who is on the camera there? The state of Utah. Who is it that the frustration is being borne upon? In fact, even in the clip, they said, Congress, you know, they went to the end of the session when they usually fund this, and then they didn't. The clip was of us. The clip was of our legislative session. They have us. Like, it was us. It was the House of Representatives that wasn't passing. Utah's House of Representatives. The issue is this. Congress didn't act. It comes on this state and how we administer this program where the public will expect answers and will expect accountability. And we better not forget that. So when you get into a relationship like this, you have to know that the buck stops with us, whether it's real or not. Now, the way that ended up getting paid for wasn't that Congress hurried up in their after having concluded their session and went ahead and passed it. HHS said, just fund it, Utah. We're sure they're going to do it. Okay? It's a mess out there when you talk about Washington. Congress is not functioning to the level that I think that your state legislature is, and to the level that I think we need to expect it to when we start grappling with some of these big generational decisions. So I want to show you this. Now, we've talked about, we've had third-party actuarials tell us what's going to be the cost, okay? There's this very generous 90% the feds are going to bring in to help pay for this new health care program. 90% is a great big number, and we love it, okay? I love it. 90% is good. I'm going to buy you a car, Senator Okerlund, and I'm going to pay 90% of that car. You only have to pay 10%. That's a great deal. But you better ask, what kind of car are we talking about? Is it a Corolla? Is it a Bentley? What's the car? Because there's actually a dollar amount that is related to the 10% you have to pay. So we've done an actuarial. We've tried to figure out. You need to know how many people you think are going to enroll so you know what your 10% is. Let's look at what some of the states that have expanded have seen. In Illinois, the projected enrollees were 199,000. This is what they projected. So when the federal free money stops and you start have to paying as a state your 10%, you're basing it on the number that you're projecting would come in. The actual enrollees by December of that year, of which they thought it would be 199,000, was 540,000. That's going to take your fiscal note, or what you think your state's going to be in for, and it's going to make it bigger. Next state, Ohio. They projected 364. By the end of December, it was 485. Another state, Michigan, 322. End of 14, 507,000. So you see this. There's state after state. We're seeing those enrollment numbers a lot higher than what's being projected. One of the simple questions, or one of the things that we've worked very hard on, we need budget certainty. We need to know how much we're going to be putting in, and we need to know it's sustainable. Because at the end of the day, we have to pay the bills. And whatever that 10% is, we either have to pay it or we have to start telling people that, you know what, with our best intentions, it turns out that we're not going to be able to afford it. Now let's go to this budget. Jonathan Ball's making these great, in a quick glimpse, kind of narration of what we do with our budgets. I don't care how big or how important your item in a state budget's appropriation is and how important it is. The bottom line is you can't have it all. Let's go back. You can't have all the budget. I'm going to tell you right now, public education is getting 30% of that $14 billion budget. Social services right now without expansion, 34%. You get 12% for higher ed, and then you see in single digits the rest of the state government's obligations. If you get that number wrong, where would you like the money to come from? If you don't go from the biggest pot, the 30%, then you have to start looking in smaller pots to find it, or worse, Go to the areas of social services where you're looking at the permanently disabled, children, people that are we are currently providing care for, and find the dollars there to make up the difference. All we've asked the federal government to do is let us budget to a number. If it's not, if the enrollment numbers come in higher and our number only were to provide 95% of that plan, why end the whole thing? Those are the questions that we're truly trying to answer and trying to address. So who pays for this? I'm going to propose something today. And I wanted to leave this because this is May 8th. USA Today is not the Heritage Foundation. This is not a right-wing think tank criticizing Obamacare or ACA. Okay? I want you to read that as I'm asking you this question. If the concerns that we have about the sustainability of the federal government and what they're going to pay in is really of no concern, if we're confident that that money will always arrive, if we're confident that the enrollment numbers that we're projecting through a third-party actuarial will actually be the case, then this is my proposal. This scenario where, because I've had a lot of physicians, sorry, doctor, I've had a lot of physicians lecture me on simple math. Don't you get simple math? Don't you get 90% for just 10%? Don't you see the difference in how important that is? Here's my proposal. And it's a bad analogy, but it's the only one I know. You're going to have to bear with me. If you were playing poker and I knew that my dollar chip, if I threw my dollar chip in that pot, nine more chips would come in, $9 more comes in, and at the end of that hand, I get to rake in my dollar back and my $9 back, I'm playing that hand every single time. But that's not the state of Utah's role. We're throwing in the 10%, and that rake is happening with the healthcare providers that are receiving the money. Here's my proposal. If the percentages are right, if the actuarial numbers are right, for those that are receiving the $9, you put the dollar in. You put the dollar in, and then I think the legislature will just get right out of the way. We'll just let that relationship go. But what I'm hearing back is that we need budget certainty. Oh, you do? I think I've heard that before. We need to know, and I think hospitals would need to know. I think physicians who accept Medicaid patients, if receiving that money, would need to know. Pharma would need to know what they're in this for to be able to project forward that this is actually going to work and is not going to look like Kentucky. Okay? If we want to continue forward, we've got to find a way to pay for it. I don't see $80 million if all the numbers are right and all the matches stay exactly the way they are. I don't see $80 million laying around unspoken for in our federal and our state budget. I don't see it. I do believe that if people are confident in this equation and they think this is right, there are the people that receive the money back by way of Medicaid dollars. There's charitable care. There's all these dollars already being spent that they're looking to mitigate those costs. Come back in, pay it. We're going to try and keep, we have Medicaid costs on traditional Medicaid that we're not keeping pace with right now as a state. We walked away from $90 million in appropriation requests, $70 million which were prioritized by the Appropriations Health and Human Services Appropriations Committee that were prioritized that we couldn't pay for. We in the state of Utah are going to do everything we can to make sure we're doing right by those who are the most needy amongst us, and that includes the permanently disabled, those that we already have an obligation for and are not keeping pace. If there is a new entitlement program and a role for the state of Utah to expand, for those that are receiving, I would argue there ought to be the 10% or the amount paid in by those that are providing that health care. So anyway, that's my talk. And look, that's not to bang on at all. That's to say that we're working together to show. And by the way, Secretary Burwell, she was writing down these states' projections and seeing that they were wrong. We had a substantive dialogue about what it means to states when they have to pay that 10%. See, that administration will be gone when that check or that bill comes due to states. They're not going to be there anymore. States are going to have to grapple with that. And I thought that in our meetings, we were able to have a substantive conversation about what that means. If you have 2/3 of the states that haven't signed up yet, 21 states haven't. 2/3 of those states are Republican states defined by a Republican legislature and a Republican governor. If you want to take this ACA to scale and you want it to be in all 50 states, start listening to the concerns that Republican states have about how you budget and how you make this responsible and how, if you're going to do this, the constituents you serve, you're providing this on a long-term, sustainable way. Thanks.
The speaker's right. If we do this, if we do any type of expansion in this legislative session, whether it's a special session or next year, we've got to do it right. And I can't articulate his points any better, nor his graphs any better with the presentation in terms of our budget concerns. He's got that right. That is absolutely so. We have, as a mandate from the state, and the responsibility to keep a balanced budget. We're not like the feds, where we can just spend and spend and spend. We have that responsibility to act within our means and do the very best job that we can. After all, that's what we're here for, as stewards. With Secretary Burwell, she did listen to the states, our presentation, and she affirmed that the only way to get the enhanced funding was if we expanded fully to the 138% as the Obama administration wants. If we could just do what we need to do to get to 100% of the federal poverty level, we would have had this issue done a couple years ago. We wouldn't be taking your time today, but we don't have that option. What we have is either we can stay the course that we currently have, which is you come to my ER and you will get bankrupt or nearly so from the bills because they are so high. Healthcare inflation is off the charts and it is still growing. And there is no perfect solution for that in terms of if we just keep going the way we can. As a provider, I feel that because that affects my patients. As a patient, I feel that when I pay my co-pays and I pay my insurance premiums, we can't continue on this task. And on top of that, we don't have the best quality outcomes in the world. As an industrialized world with all of our science, all of our technology and research, and we still don't have the quality outcomes that we ought to have. So you say, so what do we do? Well, what we have to do is work with that which we've been given. Now, the speaker has clearly illuminated the issues with money and the issues with how we have to be careful with this, and I totally support that. If we do this, we have to do this right. And we have to have safety valves if we go forth on this, whether it's Utah Cares and a PCN model, whether it's Healthy Utah and the type of expansion that, by the way, puts a heck of a lot more responsibility and waivers in place than a pure expansion does. And the Democrats aren't crazy about it, but it does achieve that goal of getting the enhanced funding. Now, why is the enhanced funding so big? Well, let me just say, when I paid my taxes this year in April, like the rest of you, a big portion of my taxes went to the ACA, and they will continue to do so every year from here on out. When we met with the federal delegation with Senator Hatch and Senator Lee, there is no appetite in that group to overturn Obamacare before 2017. We're stuck with this. And by 2017, I'll guarantee that this entitlement will be permanent. And we can tweak it. We can do things. But even Newt Gingrich had said, there is not the appetite in the Republicans to overturn this. So then what do you say? Then we are, again, left with a situation. So how do we, as a state of Utah, deal with this? That's what we're working on together. That's why I'm working with the good speaker and the other members of the legislature and the governor on some way we can mitigate the damages. We are stuck with a tax bill that we can't do anything about. We're stuck with rising hospital care costs, and we are paying this already in our emergency departments in every hospital. And so what are our options? So when we talk about an expansion, if we do this, let's do it the right way. And the question is, we know the identified population. We're pretty within the certain tolerances. We know that there will probably be increased enrollments, and we'll have to plan for it, whether it's crowd out woodwork or whatever term you will want to put on it. There probably will be some increase in that. But we have an unfunded mandate that we're dealing with. Now, you guys, if you think about that, that's the way the federal government has been dealing with this for the past 40 or 50 years, and that's the situation we have. And our state has that responsibility to work within our own budget and to do so. And I agree with the speaker. The key to all of this discussion is if we want to have predictability, we have to have a defined source for some of this revenues. And it may be outside of the state revenues. In other words, that which we pay as citizens and as taxpayers, but from the providers themselves. His proposal is there. I think it has merit, and I think we need to talk with those providers in. That includes the doctors and the hospitals and everyone else who's involved in this, and see if there is a reasonable way to go forth that will preserve the benefits of the economic benefits. Let me just give you one example, and then I'm going to let you get on with your program. There's a new clinic that we want to start out in my district. We have a group of thousands of poor patients who can't afford medical care. Could we do what we could do with this if we got the expansion money is to fund the coverage of these people under Medicaid and also the subsequent hospital care. So you say, okay, so what's new? The other flip side to this is we would be able to establish this clinic and others, bring into it high-paying jobs. Montana just expanded. Now, that's a good red conservative state. They estimate University of Montana, you know how many jobs they estimate they'll bring? 12,000 new jobs, state of Montana. These are high-paying, good-quality jobs that they could use in their state as well. So we do have the economic benefit. And I wouldn't bifurcate the discussion. We can address the population. We can address the funding and in terms of the economic benefit. So there's some advantages as we go forth. We're going to use care. We're going to use all that ability that we hope that we can do to predict where this is going to go and to protect our state and the taxpayers and the citizens of the state of Utah and still take advantage of this program. So let's look back. We have a problem. Let's deal with it in the best pragmatic way and be careful of the finances as we address the patient care problems. Thank you.